everybody. Jimmy Warren here. Welcome to a brand new episode of Guitar Talk. Really glad you're with me tonight. Now, before we jump into what's going on tonight, who the guest is, and into this great show that I have planned for you, it is pretty awesome. I wanted to make a couple of quick announcements just so you know. If you've ever wanted to dive into the world of podcasting, let's say this is something that you've wanted to do, you have a band or you have an opportunity, you have something that you want to say, you have something that is you're passionate about that you want to share, and you want to know how you can dive in and what's needed and how you can do it and be successful at it. You know, I started this podcast with 45 listeners. There's over 1.5 million today in 44 countries. This has been an Apple top 10 podcast in 9 countries, and we're in the top 15% most searchable music interview podcast on Spotify. And that didn't happen overnight. It took some time. But I teach people on how to put together, structure their podcast, what gear to use, how to record, what lighting, you know, how to use lighting and all that kind of stuff. Everything that you need to know. It's a one-on-one class. It's done through Zoom. And it's recorded so that you actually get to keep a copy of everything that's going on so you can refer back to it. Now, if this is something that's of interest, I don't have a whole lot of spots left. It goes on for 4 weeks. It's an hour a week for 4 weeks. And that's basically it. It's a great podcast, lesson. It's a good way to learn. And the good thing is that I can teach you some of the things to avoid. So that, not that you're going to not have 45 listeners your first month, maybe your first 2 months, who knows? You know, it took me a while to grow and build in that, but I can teach you how to do all that. And if that's something of interest, email me at guitartalkofficial@gmail.com and just in the subject line, put podcasting 101. There we go. Now let's dive into today's episode. Most people know I am a huge Pink Floyd, David Gilmour fan. Absolutely love David Gilmour. I mean, my favorite guitar player, of course. I mean, there's so many great players, but he's in my top three. And I've tried to have David on the show every year. A couple of times a year, I reach out to his people, and I keep getting told no. One time I was told, it'll never happen, son. which to me is just encouraging to try again in a few months. And so, so I haven't been able to land David Gilmour, right? Which to me, once that happens, the show's over with. I'm done. I'm retired, and I go on to sit on the porch with my dog and watch the squirrels run around the yard. But I did manage to get something that I feel is equally as cool as David. I got Guy Pratt. Now, in case you don't know, Guy Pratt is the bass player for Pink Floyd. He's also been David Gilmour's bass player for 15 years. Right now, he's with Nick Mason, doing the tours with Nick Mason's band. He's also recorded and played with Madonna, Robert Palmer. I mean, the list really goes on and on. This is a world-class player. But since this guy's gotten to stand on stage next to David Gilmour for so long, I had to have him on the show. Just absolutely had to have him on the show. Now, I didn't have him on the show simply because he played with David Gilmour, which is a plus. I mean, anybody that's done that is something's going right in my book for them. But I had him because he is an amazing bassist. He's a good singer. He's a good songwriter. He's an amazing bassist. And what I learned through the interview is that he's a really cool guy. You're really going to enjoy this. So do yourself a favor. Sit down, put your feet up, get a nice, cool beverage or a cup of coffee, and enjoy this conversation with the one and only Guy Pratt, the bassist for Pink Floyd and David Gilmour.
Hello there.
How you doing? I really appreciate you doing this.
Oh, that's all right.
This is something that I'd be honest, I've wanted to do ever since I launched my show, 4 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And 500 interviews in, and I finally get the opportunity.
Well, that's nice. I've seen you got a very impressive cast list. You've talked to everyone.
I've been very fortunate, very, very fortunate. And it was the pandemic,
Oh no,
right?
tell me about it, because I have my own podcast I did with Gary Kemp, and we had and that changed everything.
Yeah, the podcast. I mean, I actually recorded my 12th album with Walter Trout's band,
Oh,
and
wow.
was going to release it in 19, and then everything started to change. And it was like, oh crap, what am I going to do now? And I used to do a radio show for 7 years, interviewing guys like you and, Johnny Winter and Jack Bruce and, a lot of great people. And I said, well, let's just do a podcast. And here we are 4 years later, 1.5 million listeners every month. And,
Oh, congratulations. The funny thing is, we've had, because, but yeah, when we started doing our podcast, the Rock on Tours, which is the number one music podcast most weeks on Apple in Britain.
wow.
When we started, and the whole thing was, it was before the lockdown, you had to go to a studio, you had to get someone to come down. And then, of course, it was much harder. But the funny thing that happened with all podcasts is, the length changed.
Yeah.
The optimum length for a podcast was 45 minutes, because that was the average length of most people's commute.
Yeah.
After lockdown, it became an hour because it was just as long as people could stay out the fucking house walking the
And seeing that makes sense. That just absolutely
Yeah.
makes sense. That's great. I didn't know you did a podcast. I was just on your website and I must have overlooked
Oh,
it.
yeah, no, it's called The Rock on Tours. It's me and Gary Kemp. So,
Yeah, that's really cool. But
yeah.
it's like when I dive into everything that's Guy Pratt, I mean, you can't help but just be overwhelmed and impressed. Really with the accomplishments and stuff, because you don't get to the place of being a young boy, wanting to be a musician, to having the, resume that a guy like you has. And although I love to talk to Joe Walsh and guys like that, I much prefer to have a conversation with somebody like yourself, because it's a completely different, I think a completely different, makeup of a person, in order to be in a band, be somebody's bass player, or somebody's drummer, or some, as opposed to being the headliner, being David Gilmour versus being Gary Pratt.
Well, it's also the thing I like is because when I'm in a band, when I'm working with people, I'm in that. That is my family, that's my world, that is my life. But then, and I think the idea of just having that one family would drive you nuts.
Well, that's why most bands don't last. That's why they have that,
Well, it's the best description of that I've ever heard, and I think it might have been Gary said it, or it might have been Sting. Just said the thing is that when you're young, you want to be in a gang, and then you grow up, and not so much,
That kind of makes sense. That kind of makes sense. So I'm kind of curious, Guy, what are in order to get where you've gotten, in order to do the things that you've done, there had to be some foundational, formative things that you did as a musician that helped you become the kind of player that these kinds of people, those kinds of people would desire to have a part of the project. So what did you do to
I
develop
don't
yourself?
know. I don't know. I mean, it's funny because when I started off, I was like, I'm going to turn my mic down, but hang on, my hands a bit. I started out as a I didn't even want to be a bass player. I discovered rock and roll. It was the Who, and I just wanted that. And so I wanted a guitar. I wanted to be Pete Townsend, of course. Why wouldn't you? But my mum had said, "Well, why don't you get a nice Spanish guitar?" I was like, "Fuck that." It was the electric bit I was interested in. Yeah. A toaster would have been nearer what I was after than a Spanish guitar, frankly. So I asked them for a bass because I didn't really know what it was. And so I got given this bass guitar and it just really wasn't that exciting. And this was kind of, this was 75, the end of 75. And all the music I was into, I was always very much a rock and roll guy rather than a rock guy. It was The Who, it was Bruce Springsteen, The Stones. I like Zeppelin because it was just such a great rhythm section. I love Pagey, but I like people who sang about things. It wasn't really all just music. It was very, very important what, you know, what the people were saying. But then, of course, then punk happened and everything got thrown out the window. You know, it's, I mean, it's very hard for Americans to understand, you know, that the absolute year zero we had in Britain in 1976, 77, where you just couldn't listen to anything. You couldn't listen to any of that stuff anymore. Had to, you know, I mean, and the amount of people I know who spent the 80s buying back all the records that they just sort of sold. And so I was just playing, but that's when I caused one of the great offshoots of punk was reggae, was, you know, because obviously you couldn't just listen to punk all, there had to be something else you could listen to. And so everyone used to listen to a lot of reggae, which was the first music I heard where it really was about the bass playing. And, you know, and so, and I would say for anyone learning, like probably the best bass teacher in the world is Aston Family Man Barrett from the Wailers, because, you know, those lines are just genius and simple and built on absolute fundamentals of, you know, of bass playing. So there was that. And so, my next epiphany was when I discovered disco. I suddenly just felt, which is still my favorite thing to play. I mean, it's just quite ironic if you look at my CV that I'm actually just a frustrated disco bass player. I very rarely get to do that, but I think that might be part of what I have, because I tend to do a lot of these sort of more rock orientated gigs, but there's a little bit of disco that bleeds into it.
I tell people, you know, when we talk about different styles of music, that was actually one of my favorite eras, you know, because of the rhythm. The rhythm was just, in my opinion, it was just amazing. And although I'm a guitar player, and mostly a lead guitar player, I would say rhythm is the foundational aspect of any kind of music, and disco just had some great stuff.
Great stuff. Yeah. But then also, you know, at the end of that, the tail end of that, you then had this fantastic crossover between, you know, between like Blondie and The Clash and Chic and then it all kind of became this mishmash, and then you ended up, and then out of that came with all the other things that were happening with the New Romantics and this and that, then you ended up with this fantastic soup of sort of rock, disco, and kind of electronica all mixed up together, which, you know, which is why the 80s were just such fun. I mean, the 80s were just one thing where I really lucked out, in that the 80s was absolutely the decade to be a bass player.
Yeah.
There's no question, you know, people knew who the bass player was.
right. Well, yeah, there's some people paying attention today, you know.
Yeah.
There really are. I mean, I think people appreciate, you know, great musicians regardless in that. But, you know, in order to go from what you're talking about in the early days of, you know, kind of making your way through developing, I mean, there isn't anything that you...
Here's the thing, and this is a really terrible thing, 'cause you're going to ask me about, I don't know, how I learned the instrument, I guess, right?
Well, not necessarily how you learn the instrument, but, you know, everybody's got some things, you know, that they did during those times that they can look back on and go, well, I did this and it helped me become a better, you know, bass player, it helped me become a better musician, or it helped me, you know, because there's so much involved in being a musician more than just playing the instrument.
That's very, very true. Well, there's certainly, that's what a lot of musicians don't understand when they kind of go and play for big bands, and they'll do things like sort of write a bit or do something, but that's still not it. Yeah. It's still not it. If you wrote something, it's only there because they decided to put it on there. Yeah. It's like, because you're right, being a band, you don't make policy, you don't meet the accountants, you don't decide the artwork. You know, it's like, I mean, for bands especially, music is, you know, it's 40% of it, really.
Right.
But for me, the greatest developmental thing for me was I moved into this, a friend of mine, his mum moved out of his house. He lived in this house in a place in London called Queen's Park. It was a lovely big house overlooking the park. And he had a grand piano. And this guy was a fantastic sort of jazz funk, soul pianist. Not soul, but jazz funk sort of pianist. And back in the day, man, you know, this is like 1980, 81. And of course, back in England, you could be on the dole. You had housing benefits. So I didn't have to work. I didn't have any money, but didn't have to work. Wasn't going to starve. And we just used to smoke pot and play his tunes all day and all night. And that's all I did. We'd get up and we'd play, but we'd go to the pub and then we just listen to music and then we'd play music. And that's kind of, that was my conservatory. You know, I still don't know, but because he was just playing this stuff. I had no idea what it was. It was so outside of my experience up till then. And it was just wonderful. And he was just trying stuff out. I was just playing along and I did that for a year. Yeah. So, and I think that's what, you know, that's kind of where it happened for me.
I'll be darned. You know, because everybody, you know, I hate to go down this rabbit hole, but everybody asks me all the time because, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have these kinds of conversations with just so many amazing people. And everybody that's in a band, you know, doesn't matter where they are in the world, everybody wants to know, how do I get to that point? Right? Yeah. How do I get that gig? How did they come across it? And I always tell people, well, it's a couple of things. One is you have to be really good at your craft. You have to be really easy to work with, and you have to know people. Would you say those are the three things, or is there?
Yeah,
something?
Absolutely. For me, so I know a lot of it is getting along with people.
Yeah.
And I had a reputation for being funny.
Yeah.
You know, and because there's an awful lot of jobs you do when you got sessions. There's an awful lot of gigs where anyone could do it. You know, where, you know, you don't need to be Jacko to do it, right? Anyone could do it. So, and there's like five guys and they go, we can get him. We can get Guy. Oh, Guy's funny.
Yeah.
And it can be as simple as that. You always, never be a diva. Never be, you know, always be the, you know, it's your ability. Also, you've got to want to get along with people. It's not a matter of faking. If you've got to, you know, I love being around a group of people. You know, new, and I love the energy that comes from that, but which is true, which is, if you're going to be like a strictly studio player, you know, no one's going to put up with your shit for more than a couple of hours at a time. So you want to be an asshole, be an asshole, you know, as long as you're amazing.
Right.
But with touring, I'd say your skills as a diplomat, you know, and just being easy are as important as anything else. But you're absolutely right. But I had that absolute confluence of things. I mean, anything to do with my skill or abilities as a bass player is completely down to other people. Other people say I can do it, so it's like, all right, I'll take that. I think I'm a complete chancer myself. I don't think I really know what I'm doing at all. but you know what? It's been 41 years now, and no one's found me out. So it's, I guess I got away with it. I mean, I love doing it. I don't want anyone who I've ever worked with to feel cheated, because, you know, you know, I gave you everything I had, but I just don't know quite what that is. But sure. And I guess it's that thing. Also, it's different when you're very young, and your life is music, and all the people you're around with the music, and there's that wonderful energy. And so, I lived in this part of London where I just used to hang around Notting Hill, which back then is not Notting Hill as we know it now. It was full of squats and it was full of bands, and it's where all the little independent record companies were. When I say little independent, this was like Virgin and Rough Trade, you know, who back then were little independent companies. And you would hang around and you would get to know people in those offices. Basically, like I got to know this guy, Laurie, at Virgin Records, basically so I could go in there and nick promo copies of records and go and sell them at a record shop, because it'd be literally, you know, you're going in there with 9 Funboy 3 12 inches. Really? And it was, that was my big break, was although my first proper gig was, and I have no idea how this came about, was my first proper gig was playing with Sylvain Sylvain from the New York Dolls, who'd rocked up in London with his lovely wife, Rosie. And they were trying to, and so me and my friend, Simon Lloyd, he was playing sax, and we became Sylvain Sylvain's band, which is, I wish I'd realized that, because it meant I could go on, no matter what I did for the rest of my career, I could play the lamest, naffest gigs ever. But I have ultimate all-time punk credibility because I played for Sylvain Sylvain. So fuck you. And so my first proper gig was there was this band Ice House in Australia. I mean, you know, could not be further away. Right. And Australia really was Australia back then. You know, it really was the other side of the world. People went to Australia, they didn't come back.
Yeah.
And there was this band, and they'd been called Flowers, and they were called Ice House, and they'd had this massive hit, massive album, and then for some reason they'd all split up, and Ivor, the main guy, had sort of carried on, and he just made a new album, and so he was putting a band together, and because they were quite a sort of new wavy, pretentious, electronic, Roxy Music, Japan, Bowie-ish type of band, which, and Australia back then was very, very much meat and two veg rock and roll. You know, it was the Angels, Cold Chisel, you know, AC/DC. Yeah. And I mean, great. There was amazing music happening in Australia at the time. But, they just couldn't find a bass player who did, like, because we were all into, we'd all got into funk and African stuff by then. And, you know, we're all listening to David, to My Life in the Bush of Ghosts and all that sort of stuff. And apparently the manager called up this guy, Laurie, this Australian guy I knew who worked at Virgin, just said, do you know any good young bass players in London? And Laurie said, yeah, I do, actually. I know one. I don't know how good he is, but I could certainly do with getting him out of my office. And so that I met Ivor, and then he came over, he auditioned me. And then that was it. Then I got put on a plane to Sydney. And it was extraordinary, which was so alien. You know, I was 20. Get off the plane in Sydney, and I'm in one of the biggest bands in the country. We go on tour, and it's nuts. And then I come home to sort of nothing. Then we have a hit single in England. Then we get asked to support David Bowie on tour. Then we do these German festivals where I meet Robert Palmer. Robert Palmer invites me out to the Bahamas to do some writing with him. One of the songs we write gets picked for the Power Station album. And then, you know, and then from then it was just, it's basically 5 years, this 5-year period started with me getting on a plane to Sydney. And at the end of the 5 years, I'm playing for Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is just what the fuck just happened.
Yeah. that's just amazing. But that's the way it is, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder, is it like that today?
Right? I don't think it is.
I don't think so either.
I don't think, but then it's not fair to apply your rules to the new world. You know, that's I'm very, very wary of being the old man now, especially when people complain about new music today. It's like when you were in your 20s, just how little did you care what older people thought about your music?
Right.
You know, just remember that it's not for you. It's frankly none of your business.
Yeah.
So it's not fair to apply any of your rules to what kids do. My son does music, he's amazing. He has to be a whole different ball game. He has to promote himself. He has to, you know, it's a whole different world. He puts out his clips, but that's the world he knows, and he loves it and he thrives in it, and you know that's what it is.
Yeah,
and it's not for us to. I mean, cause I guess the difference is that you can do it all yourself. We couldn't, you know, if you really want to be a bass player. I think there seems to be a lot of gigs. There's a lot more. If you want to be like a working session player, then I think there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
But I never really was that. I mean, I kind of ended up in LA being this sort of like session work, or at least work doing all these gigs with all these top session guys, all the guys who played on Steely Dan records and everything. And it was just like, why? How? Yeah. You know, I've never played. I loved it, but I was waiting for the tap on the shoulder the whole time.
Yeah.
Sorry, sir. There's been a terrible mistake. Would you mind coming with us?
Well, I, you know, I, the reason I say that and I bring that up is because when I started playing in the late 80s, early 90s, because I was a late bloomer in that, it was blues. I was in Chicago, and it was blues. And
right,
I
you're allowed. You're from Chicago, you're allowed. Absolutely, yeah.
Right. And so, but I can recall all the blues legends, you know, the Otis Rushes and mm-hmm. Junior Wells and all them kind of guys taking you under their wing and inviting you places and, you know, and kind of, I don't want to say investing in who you are as a musician, but kind of, you know, in a way, in that to elevate all my gigs, the time playing with Chaka Khan, the time playing with Buddy Miles, all my really good gigs came from those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Telling people about, you know, about me and about other people in that. And it's sad for me to see, especially when I look at blues, and it's not all about blues, but when I look at blues, that doesn't happen at all anymore.
Does it not? I mean, it seems to me, because I'm always amazed to find there seem to be these really budding kind of scenes that it's just different. If you don't know about the scene, you don't know about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's an interesting thing happening. I know it's from my kids and friends and stuff, is that there seems to be this scene now of there's all these, and I couldn't give you any names because loads of it, everyone has such complicated names now in bands. They're either complicated or just unbelievably weird and simple, you know. Yeah. And but there's this whole movement, certainly in England, of all these musicians who play, you wouldn't call it jazz, you wouldn't call it fusion, but it's very complicated. It's very complicated, very cool music. And there seems to be a sort of reaction against, because, you know, we talk about, yes, the moronic simplicity of pop music, but it always was, you know, we sort of seem to think there's this golden age of when music was amazing. It was always, someone said, just look at the list, right, over the last 60 years, look at the records that won the Grammys and look at the records that were out, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. And it's so that has never, you know, the thing is that as you get older, obviously you're not as, because it's not your age group's culture, you're not engrossed in that culture anymore. So you're only going to hear the big pop stuff. And, you know, pop music was always shit, you know, mm-hmm. it always was. I mean, there was some great stuff, but right. So that hasn't, but what I'm saying is kids themselves, young people themselves, there seems to be a real sort of resurgence of like a really quite complicated, just people want to hear music, people having to play stuff and think about it, you know?
Right. So. Well, yeah. And in my opinion, Europe is just loaded with amazingly talented, you know, guitar players and bass players and stuff that are doing, you know, you look at like the Tom Quails and the, you know, Guthrie Govans and, you know, the people like that, where you're talking about really complicated kind of stuff, really, really kind
of. Yeah, I don't know. Is that more of a rock thing, though?
It is. Yeah.
That's not really my thing, you know.
And you were in Pink Floyd.
Yeah, but again, Pink Floyd aren't really a rock thing.
Exactly.
I've always had the, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it's crazy because, you know, one of the reasons I know about you, or the reason I know about you simply, is because of Pink Floyd.
Of Pink Floyd, yeah.
Because of David Gilmour, you know, because, you know, I hate to say it, you know, I'm a fanatic for everything David Gilmour, of course, because, you know, I'm a guitar player in America from the 70s. So, you know, but one of the things that I noticed about you that really stands out to me is that when I watch you live, you look like you are just really, you know, involved. I mean, really into whatever it is you're doing. You look like, not only are you talented in that, but you look like you're just having an absolute ball.
I'm having a ball, and the thing is, I like to communicate. It's quite sweet because he's never said this to me, but Nick Mason recently said to my missus, he said, "Thing about guys, he's a very good musical director," because I do like to keep an eye on. In fact, my missus said something very sweet. We went to see another big English band quite recently, and I won't say who, but it really touched me. She said, "That bass player's not like you, is he?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, he's not running around helping everyone."
Well, you know, when I look at the interaction, like,
but it's all about that. To me, it's all about that. And I also think as a bass player, you kind of have the freedom to do that. And it kind of is your job to keep, you know, because you're connecting with the drummer and you're the link between him and everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, and And that's a role I love to play. I love cueing people. I love kind of being a sort of stage manager, you know.
Yeah. Well, you can tell, once again, you can tell by watching you, you know, especially when, if I look at, like, just for instance, the Live from Pompeii show you guys did, the interaction between you and the other people on stage is very interesting to watch. I mean, it makes me go, damn, I wish I was a part of that band. Not because it's, you know, David Gilmour, it's an amazing, you know.
I've got fucking Chuck Lavelle standing behind me.
Yeah, I know.
And I got my old buddy, you know, Greg Fillingane standing over there, who has the same initials as me.
Yeah.
Who FaceTimes me every birthday and plays me happy birthday on the piano.
Does he really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's cool. Well, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, you're surrounded by amazingly talented people, but the interaction looks like what it should be as a band. You know what I mean? You think of that communication in the way that you interact on stage in that, because that just portrays to the person like me who's watching it from a distance going, damn, this is really good. This is, you know, it's not only great music, but it's a great show. They're really talented. They're really, you know, you want that in a band. I want that in my band, and, you know, it's hard to get.
I know, but there's also, I mean, also, but as you said, and listen, I'm, you know, I'm as much of a fan as you or anyone else when it comes to David, in that, you know, I have stood next to him on stage probably about God knows how many hundreds of times now when he kicks into that Comfortably Numb solo.
Yeah.
And it's still the same. It's still the hairs on the back of the neck. It's still, you know, it's still just what, you know, it's you know, it's the old talking heads. How did I get here?
That's amazing. So what's going on right now? I know you're with Nick and you're doing, you know, Nick Mason's show.
Yeah, and we just did Pompeii again.
Did you?
I am now one of an elite group of three people who have played Pompeii twice.
Wow. And you played probably with both of those people, right?
Nick and also just a little something for the real guitar nerds is that when I was there, I made a point. So I've now played, unfortunately it's gone to Australia. I don't have, oh no, that's Betsy. Where's Eliza?
Oh yeah.
This is Eliza, my 1963 Precision, Burgundy Mist, probably rare, she is one of only two instruments that have ever been played at Pompeii twice, the other being the Black Strat.
The Black Strat. Yeah. Wow. Which I think Jim Ivory has now, or Ursay, excuse me.
Ursay. Yeah, Jim Ursay. Yeah.
Jim Ursay has that thing now. Wow. That's incredible. So, go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
No, I was just, I do have one of these, though.
Yeah, those are nice.
With a nice little on the back plate to Guy with love and thanks, David's 2008.
Wow. It's amazing.
I'm just showing off now.
Yeah, well. How many...
Oh, here we go. I'll see you and I'll raise you. Oh, there you go.
I got one too. It's not autographed though.
What's funny is that it's such a unique, amazing, it's such a great combination, the black, the cream and the maple.
Yeah.
And there's only one other person I can think of who had that exact same configuration of a guitar, of a Strat. Yeah. And that was Nils Lofgren.
Oh, really?
Back in the 70s, yeah.
Wow.
When he was doing his show, when he used to have a trampoline on stage.
So are you doing anything right now? I'm solo?
I don't have a manifesto. I used to write quite a lot of music for film and TV. I'm writing some music for a film project at the moment. But no, my whole thing with the bass is it's something I like to do for other people. You know, to me, that's the whole point. You know, it's like I like to bring something to someone else's thing. It's which is actually quite a nice way to think about it. It's quite a generous way to make a living, you know. The sources are about to go to Australia in about a month from now, only for 10 days. Long way to go for 10 days. I'm trying to think of ways to get ahead of the jet lag. Because, of course, in the old days, I'd just stay up for 2 days before I went. Now I'm thinking maybe if I start going to bed at 6 in the evening, getting up at 3 a.m.
A couple of gummy bears in between all of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what do you do to stay on top of your game when you're not out playing? I mean, are you somebody that's always...
I don't. I'm one of those people. I don't... I have to remind myself to play the bass, because whenever I pick up a bass, I sort of remember how much I love it. But I don't mean it's like I don't practice around. I've never really practiced. I just, you know, play and like make stuff up. It was Steve DeStanislaw, the drummer, pointed out to me something, and it's actually made me think that there's actually one thing I can do on the bass where I would argue I may well be the best of all time. That I could stand up next to Jacko, to Les Claypool, to Larry Klein, to any of the great bass players at this one thing, and that's taking it off. It's just like literally. Steve noticed this. He noticed at sound checks and stuff. He said, "Man, what is it with you?" He said, "Literally, the song's finished. The bass has vanished." It's true. It's off. I'm quite funny about it like that. When I've got it on, that's all I'm doing. That's who I am, and that's where I am.
Right.
But then I take it off.
is it because you're just done and you want to move on, or
I don't really think about that. I don't know. It's you can't really just noodle on a bass on your own unless especially if it's not plugged in. Yeah. You know. It's quite funny because, like David, for instance, Gilmore, you know, David has always got a guitar on. Always. If you're sitting there talking to him, he's playing a guitar. He's always got a guitar the whole time. And it's quite funny. Something I remember Polly Sampson says, because some people will just do it with an electric. And she said, if you're watching TV, it is the most fucking annoying thing in the world, because it's just like...
Yeah. You know, I've had my wife tell me to go in the other room. I've done that myself, and probably not as obsessive as David is, but wow. Well, I'll tell you what, man, it has been just a treat for me to chat with you for a little bit and to get to know a little bit more about you. And
you're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
You know, you're extremely talented guy. And I saw the band in Chicago before the whole Nick thing, you know, Nick Mason thing. And I'm hoping you guys come back through, because I'd really like to see it again.
Well, so am I.
Yeah. So thank you so much for your time. You've been extremely generous.
Not at all, James. All right, man. All the very, very best to you, and hi to your listeners.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye. And you, mate. Cheers.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Guy Pratt from Pink Floyd and David Gilmour. I want to thank Guy so much for participating. It was an absolute pleasure getting to meet him and to have him on the show. I wish him all the best, and I wish the tour with Nick Mason all the success in the world. Do yourself a favor. If you're not familiar with Guy, go search him out, because he's one cool cookie, man. He really is. I enjoyed it so much. So if you want to know what's coming on Guitar Talk, you know, next week and the week after through the end of the year, just go to guitartalkofficial.com. There's a list of everything that's going on. You can also listen to all the previous episodes for the last, 4 years. We're about to end season 4. and go into season five. It's going to be amazing. So thank you so much for tuning in. If you got any suggestions for guests for 2024, if there's something you'd like to see, if you have any comments or anything like that, just send them to guitartalkofficial@gmail.com. I'm Jimmy Warren. Thank you so much for tuning in to Guitar Talk.